David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 430. I'm your host, Steve Raker, cosmically aware in my base of operations down in the comic book bunker. With me, just about always, are former members of Rick Jones's Teen Brigade, our own Andrew the LA Rabbit, and WW Whirlwind X Kevin.
I just got off the ham phone.
It was quite a long time ago since I was in the Teen Brigade, Steve.
Yeah, Andrew was the cute one, and Kevin was the one who couldn't dance, if you trying to match them to their counterparts. Marvel Noise is a semi-monthly podcast covering anything Marvel-related, anything we feel like making noise about. We're in our 17th year and remain proudly sponsored by nobody. We're part of Dastardly Derek Coward's Deliberate Noise Network, where you can find all kinds of noise, including indie comic book noise, where Kevin, Andrew, Phil, joined sometimes by me, talk up the indie books that we're reading. You can stream and download episodes past and present of this year's podcast over on marvelnoise.com. There's a handy little drop-down calendar menu on the right-hand side to easily navigate to past months and years. Now, our material this episode is next in a long line of comics Kevin and I read when they first came out, and we both want to read them again, and we want Andrew to take the ride and read them. We've done it to him before. We're doing it to him again.
Unread by myself till very recently.
And it's the Captain Marvel series from the early 2000s. The one... or ones, I should say, written by Peter David. Now, I had to do a little back research as to sort of what brought the good Captain to this book. And in Avengers Forever, which is the 1998-1999 12-issue limited series that's written by Kurt Busiek, with art by the late Carlos Pacheco. Rick Jones has another Kree-Skrull warlike display of his latent destiny powers, and he calls forth a group of Avengers from the past and future to deal with a Kang Immortus thing. And one of the Avengers is a future Captain Marvel, an older Genus Vell, the Ron Mars, Ron Lim created son of Mar-Vell with the white hair and the ponytail. Remember that guy? His mom took the DNA from Mar-Vell's corpse and made a baby. Grew a baby. But this Genus Vell is like fully Captain Marvel, and he's in command of his cosmic powers, and he's got the space face and all that. And when that series concludes, Rick Jones is bound to our Genus Vell, like he was way back in the day with Mar-Vell, and that triggers Genus Vell's latent cosmic powers, evolving him into that cool future Genus Vell that we just had in that other story, which really took me a while to wrap my head around.
You know, everyone funny, loves Avengers 1 million BC, Steve.
Oh, we've already seen the more boring version of this character, so now we get to see the more exciting version of that character. We're doing it in reverse since we did the Thunderbolts already.
It's funny how like they liked that version so much they quickly made the other version that version without it being that version and it still being our version, which again was... tough to really understand what was going on at the time, but it stuck, so that's good.
So you know the thing they say that no one remembers anymore, but I'm like, I remember. If you were there at the time, you might remember. I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter anymore because you'll read the stories in trade paperbacks or buy the issues. You know, once they're out, as they say. But I remember this Captain Marvel number 0 coming out before it was supposed to come out because it's attached to a Wizard magazine. So Avengers Forever is running late, and then this issue 0 comes out before the reveal and Avengers Forever, and then you're like, uh-oh. So I remember holding on to this for a bit, even though the cover kind of spoils an event in that issue.
Right, so Captain Marvel is bound to Rick, with one of them on Earth and the other floating around in the negative zone, presumably. And they switch places, like whenever the one who's on Earth bangs the negabands together. It's like the old days. And this yields this new Captain Marvel series, which ran for 35 issues, 36 if you're counting the 0-issue Wizard insert, and ran from the end of 1999 to fall of 2002, then picked up with a new volume the very next month, I believe, that ran another 25 issues, ending in fall of 2004, totaling 61 issues between the end of 99 and fall 2004, which is a pretty solid run, all written by Peter David, minus the occasional fill-in guest writer.
And you can decide which run is better.
But I digress, which is a little Peter David humor there. A tone he definitely carries throughout this series. The penciler for most of the series, at least for this first series, is Chris Cross, whom at the time I don't think I had ever heard of before and rarely heard of afterwards, meaning he worked for the Distinguished Competition.
Yeah, that's a common theme, I think, with both runs. Like, you get someone that's really good, and at some point, they're going to leave to go somewhere else.
And I mean, well, yeah, but after a whole series and, you know, kickstarting the first, I think, 6 issues or so of the second one, that's not too bad. 30 issues
no,
or so.
No, no. Yeah, I believe he went to something like Firestorm.
Pretty similar idea. Yeah. But, I mean, I dug many aspects of his art. I applaud his efforts to make faces, you know, with different expressions and stuff. But his group compositions were often a hot mess to my eye. Sometimes really crowded or, like, I mean, there are some panels where I honestly didn't even know what the heck I was looking at, but you just go on to the next one. The story, his sequential storytelling was confusing at times, but there are places where he really shined too.
I was going to jump in and say, I thought his storytelling wasn't too bad, and I thought the flow was good, and I thought he puts an enormous amount of detail in many of the panels that's not too distracting. I do feel like there's not the consistency for me.
Yeah.
And that's the one that's the most distracting. I guess one of Captain Marvel's powers is to change his physique from muscular to super muscular to super super and some of those exaggerated distortions don't work for me at times. I guess if it was consistent, but then it would kind of go against the spirit of the thing. But I wanted to say some nice things before I said the unnice things about those elements.
I'll save all the nice things because I thought he was like a superstar. Like, he was one of my favorite artists around this time.
That's cool.
I was trying to remember like who was on the other books and stuff like that, but like, I don't know if that's partly a function of the time, but I remember like really enjoying Carlos Pacheco on Avengers Forever. And then you get Captain Marvel and I'm like, I'm really happy. I mean, yeah, definitely he excels at that like expressive face where like people's eyes are like popping out of their heads or their mouth is like wide open.
Many times he makes the mistake of focusing so much on the face that he doesn't leave enough room for the head to house a brain, though. Like, don't forget that there's got to be a brain in that head. Like, There's like no forehead, and like his head just like they just cut right off behind the eyebrows. But there's so much face gone.
Also, in his defense, it's a Peter David book, so there's going to be a lot of word balloons, and he's got to make space for an awful lot of dialogue, as David likes that snappy back and forth.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. He'd handled like those comedy sequences pretty good, you know, when like this two faces looking at each other and something silly happens and they both react to it or some kind of thing. But so we're going to hit the first 13 issues, 14 if you count the Wizard Zero insert for this initial segment. And in many ways, the comic is Rick Jones's story with, you know, Peter David pretty well versed in the character after years and years of writing The Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, I probably like it's coming out of Avengers Forever, but I have to imagine that people like I wanted more of his Hulk writing or some of those sort of characters would come over here too and check out what was happening.
And also in defense of the Zero issue, it is on the Unlimited. That's where I read these issues. So you can
That's good.
Join in, and they have a tedious and pointless history of Rick Jones amended to the back of it. cool panels excerpted from his great history.
Hey, the internet's around, but everything isn't everywhere, so you might need a history of Rick Jones.
Well, so it seems perfect for, like, a Wizard magazine feature, and, like, who is Rick Jones sort of thing. Although, I guess they'd also have to amend which comics are hot that he's in and which one you should invest in. And I'm trying to remember all the weird columns, but I'm sure Kevin's much more versed in Wizard speak.
And now for
yes, that's for sure.
For this series, Rick is no longer wheelchair-bound, as he was going into Avengers Forever, and he's pretty eager to reconnect with his estranged wife, Marlo.
He wouldn't be.
Right? And he's coping with being bonded to Genus, but he's got the advantage of, like, he's done this before, so, like, he gets the role. Right? Like, he gets that he's going to spend time not here and floating around, and he's not just all freaking out or anything like that. He's lived this life before. And because of that, he can, you know, sometimes take advantage of Genus's naivete, right? Like, he can suggest to him, like, his battle cry, oh, what a goose I am, right? And stupid things like that. I mean, Genus isn't from Earth, so he's pretty naive, although he is space savvy, if there is such a thing. So, like, he does get that there's bad actors and crime and that sort of business. He just isn't up to date with the colloquialisms, you know?
I thought
and a lot of references, like, not just the goose thing, but, like, they'll keep on talking about Captain Marvel, like, the other Captain Marvel, like Shazam.
Right. When they change, Rick says Shazam a few times, which is...
Yes.
And Captain Marvel, they make a Captain Marvel Jr. joke at one point, too, right?
Yeah.
They seem to lean a little bit too much into that, just for me, because I'm out here, so all... They parody a famous comic shop that's out here and other things. So sometimes I would get distracted with a reference trying to figure out if it's just something in the real world they're making fun of. But that might just be me. I think maybe a little less of that would have been fine, but I didn't need the Golden Apple knockoff and all that. I could use one or two of those, but less in general.
You think that's just like a bit or it's just a reference? Oh, that's funny. But then it actually becomes like a story. So it becomes like, it definitely becomes something else. Like it's more, it's an ongoing thing. And if someone's like, I just imagine people, if they were upset about comics nowadays, they would be upset about these comics too, because that comic shop, Golden Apple, Golden Orange thing sort of becomes like its own commentary on like the industry and fans.
But it can also send you down a bit of a rabbit hole because you're like, oh, when the Comet Castle opens, is that supposed to be Meltdown or is that supposed to be that other store? That, like, when you start introducing real elements as a parody, then when you put your story elements in, like, I was not I would have moved out. I would be out here at this time. So I'm trying to remember, like, when did that store, like, is this, like, the golden orange, golden apple is clearly a reference. Even a dummy like me can get, but some of the other ones, like I said, I got distracted kind of trying to place in my head, wait, is this just a story element or is this something and he means us to be having a goof on?
And on the Shazam front, one of the times he calls it out is in the Zero issue, so it makes sense to do it in the regular series too, because not everybody gets the Zero issue like Kevin. And then, and the other angle is when they transform, when they change places, there's a big flash that is, you know, akin to the bolt of lightning that happens when Shazam changes. Which, I mean, they burn out a bathroom that he makes the mistake of changing in. It incapacitates a mugger who was trying to sneak up behind Rick right before he changed and, like, burnt all his hair off his face and everything and left him like Wile E. Coyote with all his fur burnt off. And another time it vaporizes a rabbit in the forest, which was fairly graphic, wasn't it?
Andy, no likey that part. Yes, I did enjoy that we're also, we haven't quite transitioned to the, we're just going to write the 5-issue arc for the trade. We're still in the things running, which I really enjoyed. But we're heading into some of the more modern. It's a fun transitional period. And I probably need to read more books of 2000 to 2003 or whatever, just before I was getting back into it. But yeah, the Andy didn't like that part. He's apps the poor buttons.
So besides dealing with being naive on Earth and being an alien, Genius is also living in the shadow of his father, Mar-Vell, who he never met, and he's trying to be the hero he's expected to be. And he's not used to this whole bonded thing like Rick is. And while they're bonded, they can hear each other talk, but it's not a telepathy thing. So anyone who's around either one of them hears one side of the conversation, right? Which makes for some awkward moments.
So many bits. They get so much mileage out of this.
I might be the only guy that actually prefers when they call him Jenny Cream Ale to that Genus Vell or Genus Vell or whatever. Like, it just, Jenny? it's awkward. Yeah, just Jenny Cream Ale. It's a good nickname. It fits, and it's better than... Because I never know. Is it Genus? Genus?
I can't call him Marv yet. He just hasn't. He just hasn't earned it.
Besides, that's Frank Miller, Steve.
But they can see each other in reflective surfaces, though, in mirrors, windows, in the Silver Surfer's chest. So they can have like a back and forth sort, which made me think of, you know, how I love the old Deathlok and his pewter.
Yes.
Talking back and forth to each other. And, you know, like Marv makes an error one time, makes a bad decision, and Rick's like, you know, is it too late to be bonded with Nova? Instead of you? You know, like they can give it to each, they can give each other the business.
Yeah. It's also good that since they're in separate places, like whoever's in control doing the main stuff on Earth, there's always those bits of what the other guy is doing, just like lounging around.
Right.
Well, I thought that was a nice touch of using the, because I don't remember them doing too much. Before, it was always like just this ghost version of whoever was in the other one. And this one, I feel like they're really using interesting stories to tell of the other world. I mean, part of that, like you said, Steve, is I feel the focus is on Rick Jones.
Well, especially
more than I like,
especially once they get planet side, because in the old days they just always floated around in space, but that gets that dichotomy gets interrupted in a few issues. And then they're also dealing with these weird hallucinations over the first several issues that they learn our visions of future events, but it's unnerving because they end up like fighting something that isn't there yet, which is weird and certainly hard to explain to the people around you.
I also like in modern crossovers, they're so desperate by issue two, they introduce the Hulk because, hey, Peter David and the Hulk. We need to get people buying this thing.
I'm sure that was on purpose because they're like, hey, you like me writing the Hulk? Just like the first issue. I think all the first issues for Marvel around this point are like double sized and it's regular size. And I'm sure that was on purpose too. Because I'm like, oh, let's make the first issue less expensive so more people will try it out. This is all calculated moves.
Or did they take the 12 pages that would have been fleshed out the first issue and made it bigger and turned it into that zero issue?
Just deciding to market it that way. Once they decided it wasn't going to be double-sized and they could stick one in a Wizard.
Yeah, that might have been a choice somewhere along the way. You know, who knows if the writer and artist knew of it that way when they were... Yeah, I don't know. That's cool.
Yeah.
So Marlowe's another major player here. She's Rick's estranged wife, and she is Amazonian in size. Another great comic book redhead, Andrew.
Yes. I think that they quickly decide to pair her up, and she might have, if you take out the fight scenes, I think she has more screen time than Jenny Cremail does, so it might be more of a two-hander with Rick and her and their little doppelganger voices she's going to acquire shortly.
She's seen and been through a whole lot during Peter David's run writing the Hulk, including dying and being resurrected, and now she's running a comic book shop, which allows for fun visuals of the store and things around the store and all the meta commentary by David that you mentioned before.
I mean,
and then drawing all those covers in the background.
What a beautiful job he did with that. I know on Sister Show, I've remarked to Kevin that when they just insert drop images, it's very distracting to me. But this was a ton of work, beautifully done. And I love that they juxtapose it with Rick Jones destroying a comic book he's reading and then puts it back on the shelf, which I thought was the funniest.
There's all kinds of stuff like that.
Rolls the book and complete. Like, who have you? I don't think I've seen anyone read a comic like that since I was a small child. Just absolutely. And it's just great. He puts it back. And I'm like, come on, Rick. You know, people, no one's going to want to buy that book that you just folded into eight different pieces.
Marlowe's also being haunted by this abrasive cigarette smoking ghost of a girl that died in her company, the details of which we'll get to. And it's a weird dynamic. So Rick has Genus in Reflections that he's talking to, and Marlowe has this specter at her side providing constant commentary and editorializing on her every move and decision. There's this funny scene in issue 8 where Rick and Marlowe are trying to reconnect, but they're but they're also each carrying on conversations with their invisible friends unknown to the other one, which just is fun comic booking.
Now what I want to know is, Kevin, did you match up the comic book covers to the real comics that are like, are those accurate covers? Or
I did do it early on because there's like Thunderbolts and all that. I'm like, okay, those are real covers. But at some point, it's like Conan, Elf. And it's just like, it just seems to be random. And I'm just like, okay, now they're just really playing around.
The last member of the initial supporting cast of this series is Moondragon, who is a former Avenger, Infinity Watch member. And she travels from Saturn's moon Titan to Earth to seek out Rick and Genus to help them hone their cosmic awareness.
Yeah, and I was already a big Moondragon fan because of all the Infinity stuff.
Yeah.
So I was like, yes, load this book with more characters I already like.
Man, no, this isn't my Moondragon. I mean, there's no bad characters, but I feel like this was a chance to have a better redesign, and I'm not thrilled with this one. The weird I don't know. I just think she doesn't look like proper Moondragon.
Floating earrings.
And I don't know. I just think some of it's also just the choices made in how to depict her. Like, he went for the really crazy skinny waist, but regular size shoulders. So it sometimes on the page, she looks, I mean, all these characters aren't real, but she looks particularly cartoony in a way. Like, I'm fine with Drax being super cartoony, especially if you're having him be dumb Drax, that's fine. But I feel when you make all the characters that, it, you need the counter. Like, you need the straight man, in a sense, from a comedy perspective. Like, usually that's Jenny's job, is the straight man, because he doesn't know anything. So Rick makes the snarky comments and everything else. I mean, you can go the other way with Marlo and the ghost girl, where they're both different sorts of snarky that bounce off each other. But anyways, that's me. I do like Moondragon okay, but this design is not for me. But let's get into the exciting guest appearances too, Steve. Yeah. Need to get to that Hulk.
Yeah. All right. So the Zero issue was bagged with the September 1999 issue of Wizard, a little earlier than people expected, like you said, Kevin. And it's 12 pages that introduces the status quo some, where Marv is fighting this giant dragon that wasn't really there.
Yeah, like, I don't think I thought about this at the time, that dragon. But now, looking at this dragon, I'm like, is that one of the dragons from, like, Dragon Ball? You know, that manga anime?
I think it's like a nice design. It looks cool.
Yeah, like, I'm just wondering now, like, if that was an influence, because that's what I see now. Maybe, like, I was definitely watching the cartoon back then, but I don't know. Now it just strikes me as I'm like, whoa, I wonder. It just looks like one of those types of dragons. I mean, I that's a familiar thing, though, because I think there was that collectible card game, Wyvern, that sort of had a bunch of those dragons, too. So everybody I'm not 100% sure it came from something like that.
Everybody loves dragons.
I'm nowhere near the expert of Kevin, but from all those Studio Ghiblis, that more serpent-y dragon does feel more anime style, because they have a few in there.
Yeah, it's that
from
more,
like, Spirited Away and everything.
It's more that Asian dragon influence for sure. Genus is incarcerated for all the damage he had done when there was nothing there that he was fighting, until the real space dragon shows up and starts doing damage, and then Genus is freed so that he can fight it. And Moondragon's meditations on Titan compel her to travel to Earth, so she heads here.
Oh, also, there's a running bit where a lot of these villains go by the Captain Marvel moniker.
Yes.
It's like a running gag like this, so that's gonna... I mean, maybe there'll be some plot point in issue 72 that ties it together, but now it seems like just kind of a funny gag.
In issues 2 and 3, Marlo agrees to be in an indie film, a la like a Blair Witch type movie, in the Canadian wilderness. And she's got this antagonistic relationship with another actress, Lorraine, who is constantly smoking a cigarette, much to Joe Q's chagrin. And the director murders Lorraine and engages in, well, maybe just a little bit of cannibalism, and becomes the Wendigo.
Yes, the Wendigo. Wendigo. But this one's a smart Wendigo, Steve, because he has a bunch of magic to make him not lose his mind, which is okay, because we're going to get Hulk, who also isn't as dumb as classic Hulk is.
Yeah, I mean, Rick puts 2 and 2 and 2 together. Canadian wilderness, that's going to be the Wendigo, and has Genus head up there to rescue her. And he ends up fighting not the Wendigo at first, but the Hulk. It's, as Rick calls it, a classic misunderstanding battle.
It is a Marvel comic, after all. Is this still the conceit where they tell the Marvel comics their plot so they can run the story, Steve?
You know, it's another weird thing. Is Marlo with the yellow shirt and the jeans, blue pants also reminds me of Mary Jane from the 90s Fox Kids Spider-Man cartoon.
Huh. Yeah, that yellow, you're right on the yellow sweater. It's definitely like codes for that. But yeah, I did. And I can I say also Hulk and Wendigo lend themselves to the crisscross crazy anatomy.
Totally.
Like they're perfect characters for that kind of everything's amorphous and muscles upon muscles and weird distortions.
We get
it almost reminds me of like McGinnis in that way. Like those big characters are the ones you want to see them draw.
Yep. They both fight the Wendigo, but it ends up being Marlowe that saves the day because she rips off his shamanistic earring that helped him keep control. And Drax follows Moondragon to Earth. And this isn't the totally dumb reincarnated Starlin version, although the old version was the Starlin version too because he created the character. But he's not yet the smart Drax as in the DNA annihilation material yet. So he's like gaining his wits back, but he still has bits of being sort of overwhelmed or confused or not quite on top of things the way he should be.
Yeah, because there's not a lot of Marvel Cosmic at this point, so...
It just seems weird having two characters kind of like... And that, you know, Jenny is still kind of a little clueless as well, and Drax is a little clueless, so... Geez, I wonder what's going to happen when they meet, Steve.
Yeah. Issue 4 sports a Carlos Pacheco cover and Ron Lim interiors. And Marlowe becomes haunted by Lorraine's ghost, who still doesn't like her. So that's the specter that's following her around. And
plus, it's hard for me to get my head around whenever I see Mounties in the comics. I forget the Mounties are real.
What?
They're like something from Due South or Dudley Do Right or something. I'm like, oh no, they actually run around in their dress uniforms. And
you elite stuff. Left coaster.
Yeah, I forget that they always get their man, Kevin.
So Rick
so
encounters.
Don't do any crimes up there.
Rick encounters.
I mean, you don't want to see those Canadians writing those stories about Mounties because the story might not go the way you expect it to go.
Rick encounters Moondragon and Drax waiting for him in his apartment. She wants to help Genus craft his newly acquired cosmic awareness skills. And Drax loses his cool and fights Captain Marvel. There's a kind of a fun, another one of these nice comedy moments that is peppered in where Genus gets knocked out of Rick's apartment and goes flying into a billboard, but it's set up by showing a guy who's painting over the Marvel Mania restaurant.
Oh, Steve, you're killing me with that.
And he's saying, you know, man, I'm going to miss the Hulk burger because I remember when all those closed. And so this was a good joke on that. And he comes slamming it.
Right before I moved out here. I mean, I got to visit them, but I still have a bunch of glasses and crap I bought because they used to have them at the gift store. But yeah, that is a sad moment for me. But I got to say, Ron Lim, man, it's nice seeing him take some of these designs. I feel like his Moonbeam and Jenny are a little more regular, you know, less of the extremes. But Drax is still pretty extremed out, so it's a nice counter to that. But yeah, you gotta have a good punch up.
Now Drax and Genus are tussling in close proximity, and the Nega Bands actually accidentally get banged together while they're fighting, and both of them switch places with Rick. Now, they're too heavy, being two of them, to maintain floating, and they all of a sudden fall towards the nearest planetoid. Issue 5 features interior art by James Fry, Frank Strom, and Walden Wong, and is dedicated to Gil Kane, who had recently passed away. So there's a lot of Gil Kane swipes throughout the issue, and it's pretty fun.
Oh my gosh, Gil Kane swipes. I got a lot of Ditko, the monster straight up a Kirby monster. Like, this was a fun... it turns out Walden Wong has a YouTube channel, if you're curious.
Really?
Not super active, but it was fun. I just was like, oh my gosh, so much of these... The cane, the... I mean, they really could have sold the cane more. There's the up-nose shot, but they don't do the the excessive hatching. But there is up-nose shots with some hatching. There's, like I said, to me, some Ditko. There's a fish Kirby monster. Just lots of great... Have fun with it. I mean, I didn't find it distracting at all, but I could certainly see that criticism. I just loved all these, what I perceive to be kind of nods to these different characters. Because there's also a subplot going with this girl that has superior powers. And like I said, that's what I mean. It's not the five-issue story. You have this other thing kind of boiling in the background. I could have done without the plot point lifted from Back to the Future, though.
Yeah. Well... We'll get to her when she starts making sense. But Rick and Moondragon fight in his apartment, but he gets the upper hand and ends up tying her up and incapacitating her with heavy metal being played through headphones on his Walkman, of course, to keep her, you know, mentally unstable.
That is so weird.
I thought that was a great bit.
Yeah.
I never would have pegged him beating her, though. That was the part that was hard to...
Well,
really?
He's been trained by Captain America. Come on.
Yeah, tell him to put that Bucky outfit back on, Steve.
Meanwhile, the planet Drax and Genus fall to is one that we know from The Incredible Hulk. No, it's not Planet Hulk. It's the one with the tribal green people and Jarella, the Hulk's lost love from... way back in Incredible Hulk 140 in 1971, who later died 4 years later in Incredible Hulk 205 in 1976. But this is Jarella's sister's tribe. And they think that Drax is the Hulk. Drax, Hulk, whatever.
Well, you'd think, I mean, big green guy, it's been a few years. No one's, you know, they don't have... camera technology. There's all painted kind of portraits and everything. It's not the most ridiculous stretch. I could see it. I'm buying it. All Drax has to do is, you know, lean into it a little bit.
And before I get into issue 6, this is one of my least favorite covers of the era, despite it showing characters that I really dig. But the cover of issue 6 is one of the things of, like, this is what I, the times that I don't like Cross's artwork, where it's like Drax loses his cheeks to make room for his mouth. And then, like, Captain Marvel Genus is shown there with his neck, like, coming out of his pecs and like, the center of his sternum. And he's, like, making this devious, like, diabolical smile looking off of the cover, like it's like a Greg Land face that's like smiling and looking towards someone that is like not there. Like it's, and what's he do? What's Captain Marvel even doing? Like, I don't, it's a hot mess, this cover.
He was in the bathroom.
I think they could have just left him off, maybe even Drax off, and just feature our Micronaut buddies.
Because
it's a Captain Marvel book. We can at least read Captain Marvel, but just have maybe a smaller Drax and the three of them featured, because maybe that would be a tease for people who would be like, oh, the Micronauts, what's going on with them?
It certainly was for me.
It's so surprising that we see some Micronaut action here.
Yeah. Maybe you'll get into those that IDW title that's going to come around in about 20 years from now.
By issue 6, Drax is set up as, like, Jarella's sister's warlord, ensuring her harsh rule over the realm. And Captain Marvel is able to take down Drax and restore him and defeat Jarella's sister with the help of the Micronauts, which is so cool. It's Commander Ran, Marionette, and Bug, although they call them the Microns here.
Oh, yeah, is that the whole legal thing?
Well, I think they have to dance around Baron Karza too, because he's a real toy. So they can only do like the Marvel stuff, not the actual toy. But I thought they did fine. Like, we all knew he's featured in Shadow. We all knew who he meant. So I was like, I'm down with this kind of cheating the system. And
this is probably more authentic Micronauts than the IDW Nauts.
Well, isn't that funny, though, that, like, so Marvel could only use the things that Marvel created. And it's great.
Yeah.
And the other comic companies could only use the things that Marvel didn't create, and the book didn't stick. So that should, you know, these were the characters that I wanted to see more of, and these were the characters that, you know, if they could have used a Croyer or two, that would have been great, but.
Although Baron Kars is a great villain.
Absolutely. So they have this page where they're referring to this adventure that took place between the X-Men and the Micronauts, where Thanos propped up Baron Karza, and there was this big battle in the Microverse. And interestingly enough, they're not referring to the Bronze Age X-Men Micronauts Claremont Butch Geiss limited series here that had Professor X becoming like this bad guy. That would never happen, right? But they, in the print version, although it was removed for the digital version, Andrew, so you were deprived of seeing this, there was an extra joke on this page, which was a fake editorial caption at the bottom of this page saying, as seen in last year's instant sellout, Small Expectations one-shot. Tom, meaning Brevert, the editor. And now this is referring to a book that never existed, and it's just a joke. But they...
Yeah, I remember there was some debate online. I'm like, is this book coming out? Does this book exist? Did they just do a footnote joke that some people are not going to understand? It was a whole thing.
Not only that, but they referred to this adventure between the X-Men and the Microns in some of the Ohotmus. So it really is a story that is yet to be told and has been left untold.
They really ram this licensed gag home, because in his apartment, Rick has a lot of superhero merch, including a ROM bust. Like, they chose every... I'm waiting for the Chuck Norris and Karate Commandos reference and all the rest of it, too.
So the other revelation of the Micronauts appearing and Jarella's planet, which we know was a microscopic planet, is that Rick and Genus haven't been transferring back and forth from the negative zone, but from the Microverse. Issue 7 follows this Floridian girl named Kelly. She's got some kind of weird reality warping powers. It's like she can do anything. And she's got a lot of teen angst built up and takes it out on people. She meets up with this teen that can fire blasts from his hands and similarly uses his power pretty indiscriminately against people who wrong him. Now, Gina,
I want to know, though, if Andrew has a lot of low-grade CGC copies of Comet Man, though.
I don't have... Well, my low-grade Crime Buster are not CGC, Kevin, sadly to say. They're raw copies, so maybe I can get them pressed and steamed and cheat up the system. But no, I'm do not have a bunch of Comet Man comics that I'm aware of sitting in my pile.
Genus has a vision of the end of everything with the two of these powerful individuals together, and intercepts them just as the teen's father shows up looking for him, and it's this Comet Man guy. Genus intends to neutralize the threat by killing the kid, but Rick insists otherwise. Meanwhile, Kelly sort of slips away. And in the end, the kid is defeated and sent off with Comet Man, his dad. But this kicks off a long-running theme in this title that surrounds kind of bearing the burden of being able to, or being forced to even, decide who lives or dies. Keeps coming back to that. Right up until the last issue. Issues 8 to 10 revolve around this cosmically powered Kelly girl, and issue 9 has a Jim Starlin cover. That's great.
But yeah, some of these covers in here, I'm like, there's pretty much a pretty good run here of covers. I'm like, I just love these covers.
Except for 6.
Now, 6 isn't the best.
Seemingly more important than the Kelly girl, though, in these issues, Rick confesses to Marlo that he's switching places with Genus, and rather than being driving her away, she's like totally relieved. Not that she tells him about her thing.
Well, issue 8 is probably, if I had to pick like some of the funniest like Marvel comics, like I think I would have to put this in like my top 10.
Wow.
Like I found it funny at the time. I think it was even the banner on a like a message board, one of the panels in here. It's just really good.
It's a nice kind of breath before we jump into this whole punch-ups. And I love the Super Skrull and the Skrulls, also great for this art team because they can be all crazy distorted and everything.
Absolutely.
And a fun, I was like, oh, I'm all on board with this too.
Yeah,
I also remember talking about some of these villains, some of these issues, maybe in a reply to one of these actual episodes before I was on, and like saying like, yeah, how come this character never came back or stuff like that. Like it was just very weird, like after reading all the Infinity War stuff, and then you have all the Skrull stuff in here and it's like new characters, new stuff, and new concepts, and I'm like, I don't think it really ever comes back again.
Kevin, you used to ride the bus and now you drive the bus.
I know, that's what's so weird. It's like you remembering message board stuff, and you're like, oh yeah, I remember replying to like Andrew or you, Steve, and I'm like, what about this, guys? What about these guys? Why haven't they used them? Or explain this to me.
So the Skrulls, who are led by their very Kree Supreme Intelligence, like, not that they would cop to it, Skrull Intelligentsia.
Yes.
They're after this reality-warping Kelly, and they send the Super Skrull to retrieve her. But she doesn't create stuff, but rather shifts them in time-space, so she calls on a cosmic hero to defend her. No, not Genus, but the Silver Surfer, who really isn't pleased to be there.
That's a good choice, though.
Hey, moves comics, so had a very long run previously, so good guest star to have. You want to put that on the cover, Steve? My advice to you.
Oh, for sure.
So it's
almost got out of the 90s.
So it's Captain Marvel, Moondragon, and the Surfer versus the Super Skrull. And a whole bunch of, like, beasties and armadas and stuff that Kelly starts pulling through this void in space. And we get back to this whole should she be euthanized for the greater good dilemma. And heck, she's like trying to force their hand. She wants it to be ended for her.
Well, angsty teen thing, Steve. You know,
David's a good writer.
Listening to goth music. Yeah. You actually hear the Depeche Mode through the comic book, honey.
So they fight their way to the feet, air quotes, of the intelligentsia, who reveals Kelly's origin having been born in and partially of the nexus of all realities in the Florida Everglades. Ah, so that's why she's got that power.
Really missed a chance for a Howard the Duck team up right here, Steve, if we're rolling in big guest appearances.
You got to see him for a second there. You got the quick the cameo of him in the Man Thing.
You know what else I love in this book is when you get all the Skrulls and all, like, everyone's just shooting, and they're like, hey, there's Captain Marvel. And then there's, like, 100 shots and explosions. I just love that.
If those were bullets, it would just be, like, raining bullets on everybody and killing them all. In the end, despite Moondragon insist that it can't be that easy, Rick helps solve Kelly's problem by suggesting that she wish her powers away. You can make wishes happen. Why don't you wish that they aren't there anymore? And she does.
Push them into the cornfield.
Issue 11 is a really fun what-if style issue with the Gemini art team of the old Captain Marvel book in the 70s. It's Jim Starlin and Al Milgrom.
Gemini. I love that.
I love this one. This was the one. Although I gotta say, in the finale, I thought everybody did awesome with the fight, having a lot of colors and keeping it busy and creative visually. They even do like a goofy kind of negative effect. And you know I can be critical about that, but I thought it was just well done. Like, it's only for a page or two or something. So I wanted to give, because I know I've been getting on people. I mean, that's coming in a few more years where they really beat the hell out of, like, Photoshop effects for an entire issue. But, yeah, this Starlin Milgrom. I mean, come on. This is a great issue for me.
Yeah, it's funny that I almost have a problem. Like, I enjoy, like, Starlin doing the Captain Marvel type of thing. But when he has to do, like, Marlowe or other characters, like, I've been so used to the way Chris Cross draws those characters. It's just weird seeing someone else, like Starlin, draw them in here. Where I'm like, are they off model? Even though they might be more on model?
You realize how expressive Cross's not just faces are, but the whole way that he draws their figures and the characters, right?
Yeah.
It makes Starlin look stiff.
Jenny just looks like a muscular guy. He doesn't look like the Hulk.
But he looks like a Starlin-drawn muscular guy, yes, which is great. And this is at a time where we weren't seeing Starlin-drawn. So this was yeah, good stuff. And it's like a story where Genus is going to meet his father, Mar-Vell, kind of.
Yeah, and come on, to see the Magus, the purple man back, Steve. I love that for two pages of classic looking, with the hair parted down the middle.
You get, it's the old rift in time space thing where they each experience it from their own viewpoints, kind of a thing, except Genus flies into the rift. So he encounters Mar-Vell, who's fighting his final battle against a gravely injured Thanos, who in this reality had killed all the heroes but Mar-Vell. And Marv thinks that Genus is an agent of Thanos. You know, one last boss battle for him to deal with before he gets to the big guy. So he attacks him and they fight. But Genus remembers Rick's comments about these misunderstanding battles between heroes and invokes Rick's name, which Marv, of course, recognizes. So this isn't the 616 Mar-Vell, but this guy is pretty close. So Genus gets his moment with him and everything, and they defeat the alternate reality Thanos, who is the Magus in this reality, Adam Warlock's inevitable future purple self.
I mean, come on, Steve. Might not be the 616 Captain Marvel, but he certainly looks a lot like him, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's got the cancer, the whole deal. My favorite sequence in this issue, though, is when Genus goes through the rift while he's talking to Rick, who's saying, don't get too close. And he's like, no, don't worry. Oh, no, I'm getting sucked in. I can't get out. And Rick is splashing in the water that he was looking at Marv's reflection in. And he's saying, Marv, speak to me, Marv. You can't do this to me, man. Ground control to Captain Marv. You got to come through for Rick, your old pal. You're the hero. Heroes can't die. And then he puts his hand up to his head and he says, okay, they die, but they always come back. Except, you know, of course, for your father. Oh, boy. It's just a big scene of you get the big landscape and the little Rick like, uh-oh. I love that stuff. David does such good characterizations. All right, in issues 12 and 13 in October and November of 2000, we have the threats of Zarog and Unarog the son and daughter of Yanrog, who was one of Mar-Vell's greatest foes.
More, I think they're new.
Yes.
What was he?
They're new.
His greatest foe, or just one of his older foes? Steve? I mean,
now, Zayrog,
you'll see on a smaller big screen someday, maybe.
These issues are tie-ins to the maximum security event, where Earth was treated as a penal colony for cosmic empires, kind of like Australia.
Are you supposed to say it that way? You can't. You're not supposed to say it as the prison planet.
But Zayrog did appear in the first issue of the Maximum Security title, so he appeared before, although this really is where they make their mark, so to speak. Zayrog...
Kevin, I think you mean Prison Pit, perhaps, Kevin? A little indie reference there for you.
Wow. Okay, yeah, we can do that.
Zayrog and his shifty sister Unarog are sentenced to Earth... And Genus is doing an appearance at Marlowe's comic shop. There's been major competition from this new shop down the street, like Andrew was mentioning before. And the Rogs see a flyer, attend, and attack. Just like Rick Warren, don't put yourself out there with an event with flyers. You're going to get attacked. This always happens. Marlowe fights Unarog, who at one point bleeds and then starts freaking out. She's later taken by Kree... hounds who make their first appearance here, whose role is to search for uncorrected psychic Kree females and take them away and surgically neuter them. So Marlowe feels a little bit bad for her fate.
Yeah, who thought that?
You'd think they'd use them
swerve into serious territory like that.
You'd also think they'd use them in the war with the Skrull. They can need all the help they can get, Steve. Yeah. They should be using them as frontline troops. And I gotta say, they're fun enough to have the tie-in, but I feel like the character designs were not anything that's gonna stick with me for very long on these two.
Yeah,
the Rogs.
For sure. Genus and Zay fight, and they're pretty evenly matched. But meanwhile, in the Microverse, Rick accidentally swats a High Priest Muckety Muck who was just walking by. Totally coincidental. But it results in incarceration, a trial, and conviction with a death by firing squad sentence. And the whole time, Rick is like, Marv, you gotta get at me, you gotta get me out of here, we gotta switch places. Yeah, and Marv can't because he's busy fighting. He's going to put Rick into a position where he's going to get blown away by Zayrog if he does. But Genus ends up defeating Zayrog by switching the two of them together as Drax and he switched places with Rick together. So Rick and the two of them switch places and Genus Vell can fly and quickly flies out of there, and Zayrog takes the brunt of the firing squad meant for Rick.
And I will say, I do like the Bloodhound design, though. I know I goofed on the other one, but that it's cool, like this kind of black and tech sort of thing, black and blue. That part I liked.
There's also this bit with Drax, who stayed behind in the Microverse with the Micronauts. Drax starts getting really antsy and starts going bonkers, all afraid, and flees the ship, like flies out of the ship, almost destroying it in the process. And then this green figure reaches out for the cowering Drax, which I gotta assume it's gotta be the Psycho Man, right? Because he used to hang out in the Microverse. He was there for a while, wasn't he? He was pretty sure.
He's a big Psychonaut.
Fun fact, Psycho Man had the first iPad, Steve.
Yes, he did. And he has it set up with the same apps mine do. I love my hate app. So that's the first 13 issues, 14 if you're counting the Zero Wizard issue, of the Captain Marvel series written by Peter David. Andrew, what do you think? pretty good book, right?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. It takes a little getting into the headset of,
yes,
okay, there's going to be a lot of kind of meta jokes and finding that balance with it and getting used to Crisscross and the different anchors. Like I said, generally, I didn't have any problems following it, and I liked it. It just, his aesthetic sensibilities don't mirror my own, which is totally fine. Loved the Starlin Milgram. Way to throw a bone to an old man. I always approve of that kind of shameless pandering.
David's good for that. Busick's good for that. These guys, they know their craft so well. They really know how to service a wide variety of potential readers. They really do. And I mean, you can see why it's a unique headspace to get into, right? And the, and like you said, the rhythm of it and everything, you sort of have to get into it. But you could see how having taken this ride 20 years ago, Kevin and I, how we might want to go back and revisit it and get a taste of it again, because it is a pretty unique book.
Also, we haven't hit the era yet of constantly, because Civil War hasn't happened, they're not constantly derailing with some event du jour. I mean, I know you talked about, oh, this is the Mac, but it was such a subtle reference to that that it didn't bother. It wasn't like, wait, what's going on? Or this is part 6 of 12 or what? It was real nice, because I know the 90s had all those crossovers, and the 2000s from Civil War on have these events. So we're in this beautiful little layer where I felt like, yeah, I could just read these without being like, wait, what's the status quo of this, that, or the third thing? And wait, something shows up for half an issue and you're like, I don't understand any of this, and I got to read all these other things. No, it's really nice something that works.
They didn't even include like gratuitous establishing shots of like Captain America fighting people in the streets, like during the, you know what I mean? For the crossover, to like make sure you knew it was part of this other thing that was going on. It was just the reason why the Rogues were on Earth, because they got sentenced there.
The perfect crossover.
Yeah, it's a good event that people can plug into if they want and add it to their book. And it's just, oh, add some aliens. There, you're done.
All right. Thank you guys for reading these books again with me and talking about them. We got to get back to this series, the rest of the series. But first, the next month, we're going to finish off the Power Man and Iron Fist book, or read how they got finished off, or however it goes there. But next episode will be a recent reads roundtable. So start getting your stack in order.
Oh, I got lots of stuff, Steve. Very excited to talk about this new Ultravon, Energon universe from Image. Oh, wait, wrong show.
Wow. Wow.
Same toy company as the Micronauts, though.
Yes. And I'll wrap up my Black Hammer. Oh, wait, wrong show again. Dang it.
That's it. I'm mentioning Marvel Noise things on Indie Noise the next time. All right, until Marv retires to Sin City, make mine Marvel.
Captain Marvel.
Later.